Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue to learn, pray, and act in our appeals to heaven. We need to make regular appeals to heaven, folks. He does hear our prayers. Look, he heard, I mean, it may have taken a few hundred years, but he heard the prayers of Israel while they were in bondage. And so there's no doubt, all things due to, you know, to his will and his time. I mean, he has a clock. Anyway, as moving forward, we all have to start uniting, stepping away from the myopic causes and unite in holding all our public servants accountable to their oath of office and hold them accountable to the Constitution, making sure that in every way they are supporting the Constitution as written. And so, one last thing, we definitely invite you to create the awareness regarding this thing called the Electoral College and trying to get the Electoral College restored in choosing the president instead of the party. So, welcome back, Tammy. And as you come back, I wanted to kind of mention that, you know, in yesterday's show, because we really ran out of time, and ergo the really quick outtake, we're reclaiming the Republic. But anywho, there's a need for me to actually now drill in, because I've read these things before, right? I read the ratification debates every year. And I've come to the conclusion, maybe wrong, which is why I need to kind of go through this. The reality is the Declaration of War is being violated as written in the Constitution. It's not being followed. The fact that the president, I mean, they don't call forth the militia. The whole point is to call forth the militia, to federalize an army if we're going to war. But there's nowhere in there where it even allows the deployment. They talk here a little bit about deploying the forces, but there's nowhere in there where the Constitution allows the president to take young men and deploy them anywhere in the world. The concept is they can call forth the militia to do three things: to execute the laws of the Union, something internal to the United States, suppress insurrection, something internal, and to repel invaders, something internal. Nowhere in there can they, into the aid of other nations. They have to amend the Constitution to do that. So, regardless, and this goes back to the brilliance, and this is why I want to bring this up, because, I may be wrong, but the reality, as Madison stated in 1821 in a letter, a formal letter, back to John G. Jackson, where he and other men were requesting that Madison relinquish or at least provide a copy of his notes on the Constitutional Convention, because these men wanted to understand the Constitution. And so they sought out, his notes, because they felt that that was the proper context. And Madison said, no, it doesn't matter what we thought. It doesn't matter what I thought or any of us thought in the convention that what the Constitution is to mean. The only thing that matters is how the Constitution was justified or sold to the states at the time or understood by the states at the time of ratification. So these are the words. This is what we have to actually lean on in understanding. Now, so the real question is there any conflict to what General Pinckney was saying regarding, this declaring of war? Was it clarified? Because I know in Virginia they get into the knickers regarding war, martial law, and all sorts of details. So there we go, because it needs to be there. But I actually want to go back into the notes on the Constitutional Convention, because not that they probably didn't debate this in detail. They probably did, But the guy that wants to be right doesn't like to have to admit, maybe I'm misspoken. So anyway, so I think we've left off with the slaves issue, and I believe we're at the point where Mr. Rutledge now pipes in. Now, Mr. Rutledge was a delegate at the Constitutional Convention, so he's basically explaining this concept of slavery, the tax, and so forth. So, are you there?
Okay. Yep. Gentlemen should carry their views into futurity and not confine themselves to the narrow limits of a day when contemplating a subject of such vast importance. The gentleman had complained of the inequality of taxes between the northern and southern states, that $10 a head was imposed on the importation of Negroes, and that those Negroes were afterwards taxed. To this it was answered that the $10 per head was an equivalent to the 5% on imported articles, and as to their being afterwards taxed, the advantage is on our side, or at least not against us. In the northern states, the labor is performed by white people, and the southern by black. All the free people, and there are a few others in the northern states, are to be taxed by the new constitution, whereas only the free people and two-fifths of the slaves in the southern states are to be rated in the apportioning of taxes. But the principal objection is that no duties are laid on shipping, that in fact the carrying trade was to be vested in a great measure in the Americans, that the shipbuilding business was principally carried on the northern states.
Right, which basically, you know, I think he's just helping justify, you know, don't get so caught up on this level of tax. And I'm not sure if he really hit the ball out of the park or anything, but bottom line is that's kind of how he sold it. So as we go down into the next day, because if you really look, I mean, he stated that, and then the following sentences: when this subject is duly considered, the southern states should be the last to object to it. Mr. Rutledge then went into a consideration of the subject, after which the House adjourned. So, I mean, end of the day, end of discussion. So what do they pick up the next day? The next day they pick up General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney starts talking about treaties. So let's dive into that.
Okay, if treaties entered into by Congress are not to be held in the same sacred light in America, what foreign nation will have any confidence in us? Shall we not be stigmatized as a faithless, unworthy people if each member of the Union may with impunity violate the engagements entered into by the federal government? Who will confide in us? Who will treat us? Who will treat with us if our practice should be conformable to this doctrine? Have we not been deceiving all nations by holding forth to the world in the ninth article of the old Confederation that Congress may make treaties? If we at the same time entertain this improper tenet that each state may violate them, I contend that the article in the new Constitution which says that treaties shall be paramount to the laws of the land is only declaratory of what treaties were, in fact, under the old compact. They were as much the law of the land under the Confederation as they are under this Constitution, and we shall be unworthy to be ranked among civilized nations if we do not consider treaties in this view. Vattel, one of the best writers on the law of nations, says there would be no more scrutiny, there would be no more security, no longer any commerce between mankind, did they not believe themselves obliged to preserve their faith and to keep their word. Nations and their conductors ought then to keep their promise and their treaties inviolable.
Mm-hmm.
This great truth acknowledged by all nations. Nothing adds so great a glory to a prince and the nation he governs as the reputation of an inviolable fidelity to his engagements. By this and their bravery, the Swiss have rendered themselves respectable throughout Europe. This national greatness of soul is the source of immortal glory upon it is founded the confidence of nations, and thus becomes a certain instrument of power and splendor. Surely this doctrine is right. It speaks to the heart and impresses itself on the feelings of mankind and convinces us that the tranquility, happiness, and prosperity of the human race depend on inviolably preserving the faith of treaties.
All right. So he continues on because he's still talking about treaties, right? But I highlight another section in the same paragraph at the very bottom regarding treaties again. So go ahead.
Okay. By the present Constitution, each state sends two members to the Senate who vote per capita, and the president has power with advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the Senate present concur. This inconvenience attended the old method. It was frequently difficult to obtain a representation from nine states, and if only nine states were present, they must all concur in making a treaty. A single member would frequently prevent the business from being concluded, and if he absented himself, Congress had no power to compel his attendance. This actually happened when a treaty of importance was about to be concluded with the Indians, and several states being satisfied at particular junctures that the nine states present would not concur in sentiment on the subject of a treaty were indifferent whether their members attended or not. But now that the senators vote individually and not by states, each state will be anxious to keep a full representation in the Senate, and the Senate has now power to compel the attendance of its own members.
Okay, so a little more clarification. Now, in the next paragraph, he starts off with discussing treaties as well.
Okay, now let us consider whether the power of making treaties is not as securely placed as it was before. It was formally vested in Congress, who were a body constituted by the legislatures of the different states in equal proportions. At present, it is vested in a president who is chosen by the people of America and in a Senate whose members are chosen by the state legislatures, each legislature choosing two members. Surely there is great security in vesting this power as the present Constitution has vested it than in any other body. Would the gentleman vest it in the president alone? If he would, his assertion that the power we have granted was as dangerous as the power vested by Parliament in the proclamations of Henry VIII might have been perhaps warranted. Would he vest it in the House of Representatives? Can secrecy be expected in 65 members? The idea is absurd. Besides, their sessions will probably last only 2 or 3 months in the year. Therefore, on that account, they would be a very unfit body for negotiation, whereas the Senate, from the smallest of its numbers, from the equality of power which each state has in it, from the length of time for which its members are elected, from the long sessions they may have without any great inconveniency to themselves or constituents, joined with the President, who is the federal head of the United States, form together a body in whom can be best and most safely vested the diplomatic power of the Union.
Okay, so I find it interesting that he hadn't dove into made under their authority regarding the treaty, whether that was just kind of like accepted as the language it was, because in the Constitution, folks, we point this out in our petition regarding treaties, but when we look at the Constitution and we look at the Supremacy Clause, which is Article 6, it says that this Constitution and the laws which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. In other words, they can only make treaties that they have the authority to make regarding trade, regarding the ending of war, but regarding the environment, regarding adjoining to a different world government and power, those things are not enumerated. But obviously, they didn't dive into that part. They just talk about shall be the supreme law of the land. So it may have just been just common knowledge that the only treaties that they can make are regarding those things that they have a power to do. Now, in essence, when they look at making treaties with Indians, they can make treaties with Indians regarding commerce. Because when you read the enumeration of powers in Article 1, Section 8, I think the only time Indians are mentioned is in the Commerce Clause. That's it. And so there may be, you know, if we declare war against an Indian tribe, then they would be able to make a treaty regarding the ending of that war. But just to go and make a treaty with the Indians to say, you know what, we're going to take you from this land and give you that land, that didn't exist in the Constitution. So,
right. So
to be clear, Thomas Jefferson was the one that pointed out, and oh, by the way, under the Articles of Confederation, for the majority of the time, Congress themselves, I should say Thomas Jefferson himself, was nowhere to be found in regards to the, help me out here, in regards to the actions of Continental Congress. He was basically serving as an emissary as soon as he was finished with his governorship during the war. So during the real heyday of the Continental Congress, Thomas Jefferson was already over in England when they were working on that treaty, the Versailles Treaty, with England after the war. So he didn't see all of these problems with the Continental Congress. He was completely oblivious because he didn't even get back from his emissary duties until after the Constitution was ratified. And actually, they were just forming the federal government. That's how long he was away on his emissary duties. So anyway, so we go on a little bit further here, and they actually talk about Rogue Island, interestingly enough. And let's see if they actually use that word. But anyway, let's go ahead.
Ask the citizens of Massachusetts if the Confederation protected them during their interaction of Shays. Ask the crews of our vessels captured by the Algerines if respect for our government hath softened the rigors of their captivity. Inquire of our delegates to Congress if all the dispatches from our public ministers are not filled with lamentations of the imbecility of Congress, and whether foreign nations do not declare they have no confidence in our government, because it has not power to enforce obedience to treaties. Go through each state in the Union and be convinced that a disregard for law hath taken the place of order, and that Congress is so slighted by all of them that not one hath complied with her requisitions. Every state in the Union, except Rhode Island, was so thoroughly convinced that our government was inadequate to our situation that all, except her, sent members to the convention at Philadelphia. General Pinckney said it had been alleged that when there they exceeded their powers. He thought not. They had a right, he apprehended, to propose anything which they imagined would strengthen the Union and be for the advantage of the country, but they did not pretend to a right to determine finally upon anything. The present Constitution is but a proposition which the people may reject, but he conjured them to reflect seriously before they did reject it, as he did not think our state would obtain better terms by another convention. And the anarchy which would in all probability be the consequence of rejecting this Constitution would encourage some daring despot to seize upon the government and effectually deprive us of our liberties.
Okay, keep going.
Every member who attended the convention was from the beginning sensible of the necessity of giving greater powers to the federal government. This was the very purpose for which they were convened. The delegations of Jersey and Delaware were at first averse to this organization, but they afterwards acquiesced in it, and the conduct of their delegates has been so very agreeable to the people of these states that their respective conventions have unanimously adopted the Constitution. As we have found it necessary to give very extensive powers to the federal government, both over the persons and estates of the citizens, we thought it right to draw one branch of the legislature immediately from the people, and that both wealth and number should be considered in the representation.
Okay, so interesting insights regarding the again, the commissions. Okay, so, all right. Now we just go down a little bit further into the same paragraph or the next paragraph, right? And actually, because you see that they kind of show the number of states. It actually says here, the number in the different states according to, and what are they counting here? We thus obtained a representation for our property, and I confess I did not expect that we had conceded too much to the eastern states when they allowed us a representation for a species of property. And to be very specific regarding this, they go on to, I believe, the slaves with the three-fifths and so forth. So if you see that table there, then go ahead and dive into the very bottom of the paragraph there.
Okay. The general then said he would make a few observations on the objections which the gentleman had thrown out on the restrictions that might be laid on the African trade after the year 1808. On this point, your delegates had to contend with the religious and political prejudices of the eastern and middle states, and with the interested and inconsistent opinion of Virginia, who was warmly opposed to our importing more slaves. I am of the same opinion now as I was 2 years ago, when I used the expressions the gentleman has quoted, that while there remained 1 acre of swamp land uncleared of South Carolina, I would raise my voice against restricting the importation of Negroes. I am as thoroughly convinced as that gentleman is that the nature of our climate and the flat, swampy situation of our country obliges us to cultivate our lands with Negroes, and that without them, South Carolina would soon be a desert waste.
Okay, so a little bit of justifications. There you go. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what they were alluding to earlier, but keep going.
Yeah. You have so frequently heard my sentiments on this subject that I need not now repeat them. It was alleged by some of the members who opposed an unlimited importation that slaves increased the weakness of any state who admitted them, that they were a dangerous species of property which an invading enemy could easily turn against ourselves and the neighboring states, and that as we were allowed a representation for them in the House of Representatives, our influence in the government would be increased in proportions as we were less able to defend ourselves. Show some period, said the members from the eastern states, when it may be in our power to put a stop, if we please, to the importation of this weakness, and we will endeavor, for your convenience, to restrain the religious and political prejudice of our people on this subject. The middle states and Virginia made us no such proposition. They were for an immediate and total prohibition. We endeavored to obviate the objections that were made in the best manner we could and assigned reasons for insisting on the importation, which there is no occasion to repeat, as they must occur to every gentleman in the House. A committee of the states was appointed in order to accommodate this matter, and after a great deal of difficulty it was settled on the footing recited in the Constitution.
Okay, so he's kind of exposing the belly here and how things were frankly discussed and, you know, his position. I would say this because I do remember in going through the notes, Madison's notes, where Madison actually captured these ideas that all of the men that were there from the South said they would gladly give up slavery if their constituents, if they had any inkling that their constituents would be tentative, listening, and susceptible to agreeing. They basically said, there's just no way in heck they're going to give up slavery, period. Yeah. Now, again, that clearly you can see here where Virginia was thrown under the bus as a state that was willing to give up its slavery. Right? That's what they're saying. From Virginia north, that's what it was. Okay, so keep going then in the next paragraph here.
Okay, by this settlement...
Actually, hold on here. Didn't realize we were going straight into a break. So because we're going straight into a break, we have the privilege of taking a second and regrouping. So we'll take on this next paragraph and more of the South Carolina debate after this short promo. So we'll be right back after this, folks. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we can move forward with the next paragraph. So,
okay, make sure I'm not on mute. By this settlement, we have secured an unlimited importation of Negroes for 20 years, nor is it declared that the importation shall be then stopped and may be continued. We have a security that the general government can never emancipate them, for no such authority is granted, and it is admitted on all hands that the general government has no powers but what are expressly granted by the Constitution, and that all rights not expressed were reserved by the several states.
Okay, so I highlighted that because that right there gave everybody an assurance that the federal government could not take slavery away. It would require an amendment to the Constitution. Okay, so keep going. All right.
We have obtained a right to recover our slaves in whatever part of America they may take refuge, which is a right we had not before. In short, considering all circumstances, we have made the best terms for the security of this species of property it was in our powers to make. We would have made better if we could, but on the whole, I do not think them bad.
Okay, so the one thing he makes at the very beginning of this here, by this settlement, we have secured an unlimited importation of Negroes for 20 years, nor is it declared that the importation shall then be stopped. And he's absolutely correct, because right there in Article 1, Section 9, it says the migration or importation of such persons, in other words, the slaves, as any states now existing shall think proper to admit, shall be prohibited by Congress prior to, in other words, Congress cannot prohibit the importation of slaves prior to that. It doesn't say they will. It just says that they shall not prior to that. And basically, it had everything to do with who the president was and how that was to be interpreted. I want to go back to the power of the divine hand of providence in the Constitutional Convention. Because it was brought up when that line was being written, it was Madison himself who reacted in such a way, he basically attested that who is going to remember that this line even exists in the Constitution, because it was a veiled reference. It didn't even mention slavery, that anybody could have easily obviated or redefined what that word meant. He wanted it to be very clear that the importation of slaves, not the importation of persons. And so he was very frustrated that this was actually, everybody agreed upon this, or I should say enough of the people agreed upon it. So, I mean, he went away infuriated. Do you think that in 1808, when James Madison became the president, because that's when he was inaugurated, right? He was elected in 1807. He was the man coming into the presidency in 1808 when this clause was now open for, you know, execution. You think that's a coincidence? No, I'm telling you, folks, this kind of puts, you know, it places that divine involvement into this nation from the dialogue to who was actually there to make sure this happened. Anyway, okay, so David Ramsey, and not the financial advisor, David Ramsey, you know, makes some comments, and they go on and on and on. And then Robert Barnwell kind of speaks up, and he actually makes some comments you can tell that slavery is a real dominant subject in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Barnwell continued to say, "I now come to the last point for consideration. I mean the clause relative to the Negroes, and here I am particularly pleased with the Constitution. It has not left this matter of so much importance to us open to immediate investigation. No, it has declared that the United States shall not, at any rate, consider this matter for 21 years, and yet gentlemen are displeased with it. Congress has guaranteed this right for that space of time, and at its expiration may continue it as long as they please. This question then arises, what will their interests lead them to do? The Eastern States, as the honorable gentleman says, will become the carries of America. It will, therefore, certainly be their interest to encourage exportation to as great an extent as possible, and if the quantum of our products will be diminished by the prohibition of Negroes, I appeal to the belief of every man whether he thinks those very carries will themselves dam up the source from whence their profit is derived. To think so is so contradictory to the general conduct of mankind that I am of opinion that without we ourselves put a stop to them, the traffic for Negroes will continue forever."
Okay, so hold on right there. do you understand what he just said? Do you kind of understand what he basically said is, because, see, there's two benefits for the northern states, because they build the ships. He's making that comment, that they build the ships. And so it would be, you know, if the continuance growth of shipping slaves in and produce out, or the products of the South back out, because they will be heavily exported, you know, the tobacco, the agriculture, because those are just raw goods that they're growing in mass production, right? So that these are the primary exports of the United States. This is why there's all this money is involved in the South. So if all of a sudden they stop the slave trade and the production starts to decrease, because, and I don't see that happening, I don't see it really decreasing, but it won't increase at the same rate. He's banking on the greed of the Northerners to actually concede with, you know, stop, you know, allowing the importation of slaves to continue. You see my point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we see this all the time in business today where, you know, I'll just say politics makes interesting bedfellows, where we would find people that, you know, vehemently disgusted and have disdain for each other. You know, they hate them and they hate you, and it, but they constantly make deals and mutual benefits for both in this cause of doing bad things. And so he's pointing to the nature, or that the greed and the avarice that is an element in humanity. But interestingly enough, the real fact that how this played out, history, you know, because this is a 21 year in advance before this really played out, right? So how did it really play out? The northern states didn't see the disadvantage in demanding the cut, or supporting the cut of this slave trade, which is why Congress actually started executing, and the abolition movement was growing stronger and stronger in 1808. And so much so that this is why I say the real proof that the Southern states actually were seeing the reckoning coming. In other words, the end of their slavery was, they saw it coming well before 1820, which is why they were motivated in trying to corrupt enough people in Congress to allow the Missouri Compromise to be established to galvanize the establishment of slavery so that it would propagate into more states, forcing it upon states so that there could never become an advantage, a significant advantage in the Senate, because that's the, you know, when you start looking at the representation and in the Senate, and actually they were seeing their numbers dwindling in the House of Representatives, but as long as they could maintain equality of slave states to free states, the Senate would never allow an amendment to move forward to the states to end the slave trade. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the Missouri Compromise was so critical in saving slavery. In other words, folks, this I'm giving you the academic argument that slavery in the after 1808, and everybody was moving forward with this abolition, the Southern states literally panicked. And they started getting their money out of their grubby hands and starting to get judges and other people, jurists, lawyers, getting them into office and making sure that they had enough people in Congress to support the Missouri Compromise, which was a direct violation of the admission of states into the Union, forcing upon them slavery, taking away their free will, their ability to self-determine how and what type of state they would be. I mean, this goes to the core of, you know, the Union and this concept that every state was an independent and sovereign state, free to choose for themselves. Instantly, they, boom. And that was the beginning of the corruption and the destruction of the Republic. To where we see today, you know, we don't have our Republican form of government. We have democracies. I mean, it all began with that. Anyway, go ahead and finish this last part, though. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Barnwell concluded by declaring that this Constitution was, in his opinion, like the laws of Ceylon, not the best possible to be formed, but the best that our situation will admit of. He considered it as the
panacea
of America, whose healing power will pervade the continent, and sincerely believe that its ratification is a consummation devoutly to be wished.
Okay. All right. So now we go on a little bit further, and on that same day, under the Honorable Arthur Simpkins, he makes a couple comments.
Of 96 asked for information whether Congress had a right to interfere in religion. General Charles Cotesworthy Pinckney answered they had no power at all and explained this point to Mr. Simpkins' satisfaction.
Okay, so can Congress determine, I mean, they don't have any power over education. Right? That's not in the Constitution, right? It's not a delegated power. But if Congress decided, or the Supreme Court, because they didn't ask about the Supreme Court, could the Supreme Court litigate? They didn't go into these things because all of these things would be considered, you know, abhorrent violations of the Constitution, such as the judiciary creating law. And here in 1920, with the Scopes trial, where the concept of teaching evolution versus creation in the school system in Pennsylvania was being argued one in front of the federal court, the Supreme Court, which it's a topic that did not arise under the Constitution. They should never have heard this case. This should have been kept and stemmed and ended in Pennsylvania. And if every state had to go through the same process, it would be, you know, done and decided in each state differently. But the bottom line is, when the courts actually determined that evolution would be taught in school and that creation would no longer be taught, how is that not an interference and a law respecting religion?
Totally.
I mean, I'm just showing you folks how far out of the seams
and
the boundaries.
Evolution itself is, in a sense, a religious belief. So.
It is, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And it's taking away creation, which is a religious that's already been in the school. You know, they've been teaching creation since before the Constitution in school. We then dive further and further down, and then we get into the enumerated objects. So this is under General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, talks about the enumeration. So let's go ahead and pick that one up.
The general then, in answer to Mr. Lona's objections that the powers vested in the general government were too extensive, enumerated all the powers granted, and remarked particularly on each, showing that the general good of the Union required that all powers specified ought necessarily to be vested where the Constitution had placed them, and that as all the powers granted sprang from the people and were to be exercised by persons frequently chosen immediately or immediately by the people, and that as we had a great a share in the government in proportion to our importance as any other state had, the assertion that our representation would be merely virtual, similar to what we possessed under the British government, was altogether unfounded, that there was no danger of the powers granted being abused while the people remained uncorrupt, and that the corruption was more effectually guarded against in this manner, in the manner this government was constituted, than in any other that had ever been formed.
And he's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. The problem was they didn't see the corruption of the states happening that fast. Because the Assumption Act, as soon as the states realized they didn't have to pay the debt, and many states actually benefited because the states that didn't pay the debt, well, they got relieved of that debt, but in compensation to the states that paid their debt, they actually got money back because the federal government had to assume equally debt of each of the states. That uniformity clause was alive and well. And this is how all of the states that were receiving, one way or another, a major financial benefit from Congress. Oh, the windows of heaven have opened upon the United States and has poured out this financial blessing unconstitutionally. Because it was clearly a violation, and Madison was driving that point home, and he was winning the argument until Thomas Jefferson, and I remember we covered this, and we're going to cover it again when we're all done with this, because we're going to go over those things again. And so it's just a shame to think that, you know, they had this system that wouldn't be corrupt as long as the federal government functioned the way they were supposed to. As long as they didn't allow Hamilton to, you know, print money and actually start going down this path of giving everybody money. Okay, so anyway, or giving everybody financial benefits. Now the state legislatures, they were eating out of his hands. Okay, so because everybody was now, they were burden free. They didn't have to worry about the debts and you know, the states that actually paid their debts. You know, they may have had somewhat of an advantage, but, you know, they still had their, you know, regular struggles, but everybody benefited. Anyway, the uniformity clause comes down a little bit later. So let's read that one now.
Okay. I have before spoken of the policy and justice of vesting the majority of Congress with the power of making commercial regulations and the necessity there is in all well-constituted republics that the majority should control the minority, and I should have had a very strong objection if I had contained the restrictive clause. If it had contained the restrictive clause the honorable gentleman appears so anxious for, the Congress should not have it in their powers to prevent the ships of any nation from entering our ports. I cannot think it would have been prudent or fitting to have given the ships of all foreign nations a constitutional right to enter our ports whenever they pleased, and this, too, notwithstanding we might be at war with them, or they may have passed laws denying us the privileges they grant to all other commercial nations, or circumstances not now foreseen might render it necessary for us to prohibit them. Such a clause would have injured the eastern states, would have been eventually detrimental to ourselves, and would have in fact amounted to a declaration that we were resolved never to have a navy.
Okay, so interestingly enough, he's really not mentioning the uniformity clause, but he's pointing out that there has to be a uniformity, not just applied to the states as far as advantages, but they had to treat all states, foreign states, equally or not. And so the reality is that if the federal government had the ability to create friends of nations and, you know, I'll just say not friends of nations, they would be the ones who could decide. And the ability of doing this was very, very important. And so keep going, because down further in this paragraph, there's another highlight. So keep going.
Okay. The general government could not abuse this power and favor one state and oppress another, as each state was to be taxed only in proportion to its representation and as to excises. When it is considered how many more excisable articles we manufactured to the northward than there are to the southward, and the ease and convenience of raising a revenue by indirect taxation, and the necessity there is to obtain money for the payment of our debts, for common defense, and for the general welfare, he thought every man would see the propriety and even the necessity of this clause.
Of maintaining uniformity, maintaining the same equal burden. So, bottom line, he doesn't really talk about it directly. He doesn't mention it, but he wants to make sure that it's well understood that they don't want the general government to have any kind of power to choose one state or advantage a foreign state over another and so forth, that they needed to put the needs of the union above all things, because if they can't create preferences at home, they can't create preferences abroad. It would be equally applied. In other words, what I'm saying is if England was going to be barred from being able to do trade with America, then it would be equally applied to all of the states. But see, under the Articles of Confederation, all of the states were creating their own little private treaties, because in some respects, certain states would benefit in providing very specific trade deals with those states. I mean, some states don't even do any trade with a certain state, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when we look at the northern states where they're making furniture, making shoes and so forth, they're not importing shoes, furniture, and blah, 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 right? They're not bringing it in. But when we look at food, you know, the production of food, tobacco, those types of products, the South isn't bringing that stuff in from foreign markets. And so that's why the federal government had the role and responsibility of regulating commerce with foreign nations, but not amongst the states. So what they needed to do was they needed to make sure that they applied enough protections equally to ensure that, you know, there was an advantage of buying American instead of buying, you know, foreign commerce being shipped in. You really wanted to have that, you know, that that Rolex watch instead of, you know, the citizen's watch of of Massachusetts, then okay, you paid extra money for that Rolex watch. Anywho, so let's keep going down, because Mr. Rollins Loudens talks about the Navy. Go ahead.
Okay. It was urged that until we had a Navy powerful enough to protect us, our liberties and property were held only on courtesy. But if gentlemen adverted where this Navy so necessary was to come from, not from the southern states, but the northern ones, they would easily perceive to whom this country would belong. It was true, the old Confederation was a mere paper defense, but then it was a good proof on our behalf if we were overcome by unmerited wrongs. Some had made this question, will you join or will you be single? For his part, he did not think matters had come to such a crisis. Rather, let us comply with our federal connection, which not yet being broken, admits of being strengthened. A gentleman had instanced Vattel in support of his argument and laid down from that offer and that author an opinion that where parties engaged in the performance of an obligation, should any one of them fly off from this agreement, the original was null and void.
That right there is a standard understanding of a contract. In other words, this is being stated somewhere else by Madison, that when one line of the contract, because there's all these interdependencies within a contract, that if one line is violated, it basically means that all lines are being violated. Madison even goes further in his report on the Virginia resolutions, why they didn't nullify, or more importantly, why they didn't go to extreme measures, is because the violation had to be significant in nature and willful. In other words, something that they knew they were doing. And so, bottom line, there's always the standard that had become a principle in the laws of nations that, yeah, you could try to get out of a contract, but you really had to prove that it was material and willful. So anyway, he goes into more details, and reading through this, when he talks more about Vattel, you know, I think it's very insightful, but this is all basically the clarification of contracts. So now, General Charles Coatsworth Pinckney now makes some comments regarding enumerations. Go ahead.
The general government has no powers but what are expressly granted to it, and it therefore has no power to take away the liberty of the press. That invaluable blessing which deserves all the... Hold on.
Yeah, it's pronounced right there. Encominem. Warm...
Warm going in praise.
Yeah, so we're out of time. As you can tell, folks, we're out of time. So we'll have to pick this up and the pronunciation of the word. But bottom line, they're really laying out in South Carolina, the very same way of the other states, what the Constitution means. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.